You can imagine the agony and the distress of the parents who are trying to come to terms with the teenage pregnancy of their young daughter. She was being educated at a Christian school, and I asked them, how did the school react? Oh, they expelled her, was the answer. Why, I asked. Well, came the answer, you know, they're the type that find it hard to handle when Christianity meets the real world. Could have actually been 101 other issues going through the school's mind as they were responding to it. But the line just stuck with me. And I want to say that we're going to be in the real world this lunchtime. The real world of Jesus' agonizing cry from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Probably the most puzzling sentence that Jesus said. And people find it very hard to handle, don't they? For some, they regard this as a cry of loneliness. And they try to come to terms with it and speak of it more in terms of this is how Jesus felt rather than how it was. It becomes not a complaint that God had abandoned him, but that God had allowed him to feel abandoned. And the feelings are true, as we'll see. The explanation's neat. But if you go back to where Jesus is quoting from, which is one of the Psalms, Psalm 22, the psalmist isn't speaking of feelings there. He speaks of being. He doesn't say in that psalm, as he does elsewhere, why are you so downcast, O my soul? He says, oh my God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. There's a reality check needed. This isn't just a cry of how Jesus felt. Others, of course, they jump on the bandwagon of this and they speak of it as a kind of cry of doubt. My God, why have you forsaken me? As if Jesus fell at the final fence, you know, as if he cracked when he was on the cross, as if he showed, as we say, that, you know, he was only human after all. But then again, if we look at it, he may not call God Father. It's actually the only recorded prayer of Jesus where he doesn't call God Father. But then he is quoting the psalmist. But notice how he does pray. My God. My God. It's not quite such a simple cry of doubt, is it? I mean, it reflects many of our doubts and questions, but it's far too glib to suggest simply that Jesus shared them. So, what is it? Well, we're going to try and face some more realities this lunchtime. They're bleak, but they give us clues as to what to make of this cry. Let me begin here. As Mark writes, he wants us to see, first of all, the darkness of the scene. It's there in verse 33. It's the background to Jesus' cry. At the sixth hour, we read, that's midday, 12 noon. Darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. Now, darkness in daytime is always eerie, isn't it? If you've been around for any kind of eclipse, you know, it just feels odd and wrong. By the way, this couldn't have been an eclipse. The moon's all in the wrong place for that to be the explanation. He's been building up to it, in a sense, the agonized praying in Gethsemane, friends abandoning him, then everyone deserting him and fled. And now this, as Jesus is nailed to the cross, darkness falls, and the darkest of all circumstances is matched by the darkest of all skies. And in the Bible, for very obvious, understandable reasons, darkness in daytime is symbolic of God's anger. And it's what we've got here. As Mark describes Good Friday, at the sixth hour, darkness comes over the whole land. The backdrop to Jesus' cry is this darkness. It's not just a cry born out of physical agony, the excruciatingly painful though the crucifixion was. This is a cry set against a backdrop of spiritual agony. As Jesus hangs on the cross, it wasn't merely the rough justice of a rigged human trial that he's tasting, but the judgment of God himself. The backdrop is deliberately ominous. You see, as Mark paints a picture of God's judgment falling, suddenly the screen goes blank. Black. Nothing to see now. Imagine yourself there. Actually, when you can't see anything, hearing is all the more acute, isn't it? I'm waiting for what I can hear. And when you hear the cry, the shock is not that judgment is being tasted. No, no, in a sense I'm expecting that. The shock is who's tasting it. There's a rebellious, cruel, mocking, stubborn crowd all around. But of all the people, it's Jesus who cries, my God, why are you forsaking me? See, the darkness of the scene speaks of God's judgment falling, but as you listen, you hear the darkness of the separation. My God, why have you forsaken me? These are the only words of Jesus from the cross that Mark records in his gospel. Striking, really. He clearly sees them as hugely significant, the lesson that he wants us to learn. And the horror is emphasized by almost every word. Jesus has borne the shame, the nakedness, the torture, the pain, but for him this is the ultimate agony. For friends and disciples to betray and abandon him, that's bad enough, but this is almost too much. My God, why have you forsaken me? Now, we've probably, most of us, come across them, the couple. And one dies, and as you talk with your friends about the survivor, you say to yourself, I don't know how he or she's going to cope. You know, they always did everything together. It's like that here. You see, the Father's world was Jesus' world. He did everything the Father told him. He spoke what the Father had given him to say. And now, you have forsaken me. You've forsaken me. And to be God forsaken was a new experience for Jesus. As I listen in, I'm feeling the injustice of it all. So what must Jesus have felt? You've forsaken me. Me, of all people, the innocent one, just faithfully doing your will, and now this abandoned. You see, put together what we've seen, the darkness of the scene and God's judgment falling, the darkness of the separation and God's judgment falling on Jesus. As we try to puzzle out what's going on, the answer, of course, to use another scripture, is that this is what happens when God made him, Jesus, to be sin, who knew no sin. Jesus took the role voluntarily, willingly. It was his purpose and ambition. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. But when God, who is of purer eyes than to look on evil, made him to be sin who knew no sin, he had to look away. He had to turn his back on his Son and abandon him. Why? Well, to deal with sin. Our sin. God made him to be sin who knew no sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God, right with God. The righteous one, abandoned by God, so that guilty ones can be right with God. My God, why have you forsaken me? The cry may be a question, that's how the psalmist framed it, but Jesus knows the answer. The answer to it lies somewhere in these depths of God's judgment falling, and God's judgment falling on Jesus, so that this darkness might also bring salvation, rescue. God's judgment falling on Jesus and rescuing me. You know how it is sometimes when someone tells you something that's clearly been chewing them up for days and weeks and months and sometimes even years. And you hear it and your heart goes out to them and you say to them, you know, why didn't you tell me? And they look at you and they said, I thought you wouldn't understand. I thought you wouldn't understand. See, there are moments, aren't there, when we treat God like that. We wonder, what's the point in talking to him about it? You know, what would he know about it? Well, remember on those occasions, this cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? He knows more than we sometimes imagine. We don't have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, the New Testament tells us. What do I do with that truth? Well, let's then approach the throne of grace with confidence. so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in our time of need. I don't know whether you're a victim in life at the moment. Most of us are at one level or another. But you're not more of a victim than Jesus was then. Sinless, yet why have you forsaken me? You see, have you come with whatever's victimized you and said, Lord, you know. You know, you can actually talk to this Lord about injustice and he understands. Oh, for us, it may not be more than taunts. For some, it's been genuine physical torture. But Jesus has been through it and more. Or maybe it's just aloneness. Life seems a one long abandonment. Friends gone, God gone. You prayed and prayed and nothing. What some call the dark night of the soul is your experience. It's ironic, isn't it, that even then you can say, Lord, you know. The Jesus who tasted deeper darkness than that. My God, why have you forsaken me? The darkness tells me of a God who feels for me, who's with me, who's not remote, he's actually been there. And yet, if we're going to get real, this darkness is more than just a way of making it clear to us we've a God who sympathizes, who knows, who empathizes. My God, why have you forsaken me? It's more than sympathy. It's more than God telling us he knows and he understands. This is God shining the light of his love into our darkness. This is an abandonment we need never know. Jesus was God forsaken so that we need never be. Not in reality, not in the depths he was. Feel it. Yes, we might do that. Be it. We need never go there. Picture, you see, is not complete unless we follow Mark's camera as it whisks us from the darkness of Calvary into the bright lights of the city centre and the temple and the shock of that curtain torn in two. Did you notice it there in verse 38? The curtain of the temple was torn in two. And to the Holy of Holies, to walk into God's presence itself. In that God abandonment, someone wrote, the God who abandons his son is freely present, resolving the problem of our sin. Lord, you know. What a relief to be able to say that. Yes, but Mark isn't happy until I can also say, Lord, you rescued. Lord, you know. He knows the darkness so that I can step into the light. Lord, you know. But some people seem almost to stay there, to be content just with a God who understands. But Lord, you know, needs to lead me to the God who welcomes, not just to the God who abandons. Do you remember Captain Corelli's Mandolin? That novel that got turned into a film? There's a scene in it where everyone's getting shot up and... Here's how it goes. After the shooting began, the soldiers wheeling and dancing in the horizontal rain were crying out. What no one had seen was that at the order to fire, Carlo had stepped smartly sideways like a soldier forming ranks. Antonio Corelli, in a haze of nostalgia and forgetfulness, had found in front of him the titanic bulk of Carlo Guercio, had found his wrists gripped painfully in those mighty fists, had found himself unable to move. Carlo stood unbroken as one bullet after another burrowed like white-hot parasitic knives into the muscles of his chest. And eventually, Carlo flung himself over backwards. Corelli lay beneath him, paralyzed by his weight, drenched utterly in his blood, stupefied by an act of love so incomprehensible, so filled with divine madness. But he didn't hear the sergeant's voice. The scene was written as a deliberate echo of Christ on the cross, standing and taking the judgment in our place. An act of love so filled with divine madness. My God, why have you forsaken me? See, think about it, and it changes my view of God. How terrible to think of that God as remote and not understanding. Think about it, and it changes the view of myself. How awful my sin must be if that's what was needed to put it right. Think about it, and I can only wonder at his love. How could God go through that for me? The real world of teenage pregnancy, met not by expulsion, by a love that's an act of divine madness. Let's thank God for it. Amen.